From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a year covering the pandemic, two reporters talk about their experiences.
I was doing the same thing that everybody else was doing. I was like dropping $400 at Kroger, buying, you know, canned goods and everything.
While vaccines have changed the outlook, many of the realities of last year are still present.
There was another nurse who said she lost every single patient for 2 months straight. Not one of her patients survived. And these are not experiences that these people will get over anytime soon.
Also, a wildfire in the GOP over Donald Trump and election results.
John James put out a video saying, listen, when half of the voters in my state believe that the election was cheated, then we have a real problem here. And it's like, well, wait a second. You are the one telling them in the first place that it was cheated.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to talk with longtime politics correspondent Tim Alberta of the website Politico about the rift in the GOP and what it might mean for some of Michigan's Republican leaders.
The fact that so many members of Congress are so passionately investing themselves in this and throwing the credibility of their office behind this effort, I think it speaks volumes about where this party is and where it's going over the next several years.
But first, our state is reaching an awful milestone today. We can't know for sure how many COVID cases are out in our communities, but the number of confirmed cases is expected to round the 500,000 mark today. That's at least 500,000 people who've been infected. Sometimes a look back helps us focus what may be ahead. And we've invited two Michigan radio reporters today who've covered aspects of the pandemic, Kate Wells and Dustin Dwyer. Kate, Dustin, welcome.
Thanks, April.
Thanks.
Kate, you're based in Southeast Michigan. Dustin, you've been reporting from West Michigan for many years. And while there have been serious situations on both sides, I know that what you saw on the ground over the last 10 months looked pretty different. Dustin, when this pandemic started, is my memory right, you were actually in the hospital yourself?
I was in the hospital for the first week of March. So that was before we had our first confirmed case in Michigan, but there was coronavirus in the United States. I had gone into the hospital February 28th. I had a heart surgery that had been scheduled, and I ended up in the recovery of that, ended up in the ICU. So I had sort of this firsthand look, not as a reporter, but as a patient inside an ICU just a few weeks before the lockdown really started.
Is there anything that you remember about maybe how medical professionals were talking about the situation at that time or just the seriousness with which they were taking it?
Yeah, I had a conversation with one of my nurses, you know, just in a normal conversation. She was sort of like, what do you do? And I said, well, I work in news. And she was saying that she had to turn the news off because she was hearing too much coronavirus and it was just everywhere. And she was making the point that, as a lot of people made back then, that the flu was really bad, and a lot of people underestimated the flu. It had been a really bad flu year in Michigan all the way back in January of 2020. It feels like a million years ago, but I was reporting last January on schools in West Michigan being closed because of the flu. So it had just been this bad flu season, and they were already full. I mean, the ICU, when I was there, there weren't any available beds. And so my thought was, if this coronavirus does happen, if it is as bad as they say it's going to be, where will the people go?
Kate, you were covering Michigan's presidential primary race when all of this began, which I think a lot of us assumed was going to be the story of the year. But you quickly shifted to be part of the team that was covering the pandemic full time. What were you seeing that spring?
I think we all remember how quickly this happened. I mean, I remember going to the first press conference about when we had the first known COVID-19 death. It was a Beaumont press conference. I show up there, and for the first time, all the reporters in there were sort of standing like 6 to 10 feet apart from each other. And I remember how we were all just sort of constantly craving any new piece of information, but also feeling wildly terrified and overwhelmed. And I was doing the same thing that everybody else was doing. I was like dropping $400 at Kroger, buying, you know, canned goods and everything. And my partner is an emergency medicine doctor. And I remember that at first he felt like this was sort of being overblown. I remember us sitting outside a bar a couple of days later when it really hit everybody that this was going to be extremely serious, that this was real, and that this was right here in Michigan. And the two of us just looking at each other and being completely terrified of what this upcoming year was going to be and what he and his coworkers were starting to see inside these hospitals in Southeast Michigan.
Yeah. Dustin, was there a moment when the gravity of what was happening hit for you?
Well, West Michigan was very different in those early days. And like I said, I was still recovering from my surgery. I was not at work. And even just sort of personally, I didn't know as many people who had it. It just wasn't over here in the same way that it was in Southeast Michigan. But it changed things. It affected things. And certainly, you know, the biggest thing in Grand Rapids was on May 30th, following the death of George Floyd, when there were protests in Grand Rapids and downtown was sort of ransacked. And I was down there covering, you know, people bashing windows and setting fires in the streets. That certainly felt different. And it wasn't, you know, covering the virus, but it was clear. I vividly remember seeing fires in the middle of the street in downtown in my city and just feeling like things that seemed so unimaginable were now real.
How has the messaging and the tone changed over the past year from the doctors and health systems that both of you have interacted with? Kate, could you maybe start us out?
Yeah, I think the messaging and the thing that we hear from healthcare workers has stayed very consistent in terms of them saying, this is serious. If you're not seeing what this does to patients up close and what it's like to have to die alone, essentially, other than the healthcare workers who are maybe holding up an iPad for you to see your family, then you can't understand how serious this is. Please take this seriously. I think what we started to see this fall and really experience, especially before the vaccines came out, this exhaustion. And I think even as, you know, reporters, we felt this too, of saying to each other, like, we're just telling people the same information over and over and over again. And it seems like a certain subset of people get the message, but are understandably fatigued and just need to be able to live something akin to a normal or sane life. And others are just deciding that this doesn't affect them in the same way. And it seems very hard to change anybody's minds. We'd talk with these, you know, these healthcare workers and these contact tracers who were seeing and experiencing the exact same thing. Contact tracers who would be calling people, telling people that they needed to quarantine, that they'd been exposed, people telling them, yep, I got it, while they would like literally hear them starting up their truck and driving somewhere at the same time. So that exhaustion felt really tangible.
Dustin, in light of that, I think I'd like to change gears a little bit and ask you a slightly different question. Given that level of exhaustion that Kate was talking about, can you think about a medical professional that you've spoke with whose situation or outlook has been fundamentally changed by the pandemic?
Well, yeah, I talked to a nurse in Muskegon who quit her job because she couldn't take it. I mean, one of the things that happened with this virus in particular is that I heard this from multiple nurses that when it got to a certain point, they felt like there was nothing they could do. And for someone in the nursing profession, you know, as one nurse told me, you know, there's always something we can do to make the patient more comfortable. Even if we know the end is coming, you can fluff their pillow, you can get them a drink, you can do whatever, you can bring their family in. And those were things that they just couldn't do with these patients. They would reach a point where all they could do was watch. And that took an enormous toll on the frontline healthcare workers that I spoke to. There was another nurse who spoke to me in Muskegon who worked in the ICU who said she lost every single patient for 2 months straight. Not one of her patients survived. And these are not experiences that these people will get over anytime soon. The families obviously won't get over them either. I mean, the people who lost their lives, the people who are still struggling with some, you know, symptoms of the virus, but also the healthcare professionals. It's not as if, you know, everything will magically change in a few months and everyone will forget that this ever happened.
Yeah. I wanted to ask the both of you what your questions are and concerns going forward into 2021, based on everything that you saw last year. Dustin, you want to go first?
I have a million questions. Questions about the virus. I still want to know what's this going to be like in the interim between when most people are able to get their first dose, when they get their second dose of the vaccine, and how is behavior going to change? Are we going to see cases rise again in West Michigan and throughout Michigan? We've been really lucky to see cases declining. But I look at the numbers every single day to wonder, are we going to see another increase? Broader than that, I mean, I still think there's just a lot of changes that are coming. Like I said, the people who experience this up close are going to have a lot to deal with in the coming year. And I think our economy is going to have a lot of shakeout. There's still many people without jobs, still many people who can't pay their rent. It's far from over.
Kate Wells, how about you?
Yeah, I think the question and the thing that I'm really struck by is also related to vaccines. My technical question that I hear a lot of healthcare workers who have even gotten vaccinated asking is, when will we have enough people vaccinated so that we will have enough data to be able to answer the question of, once you are vaccinated, are you still capable of transmission? Can you still get somebody else sick, even if you yourself are largely immune to serious symptoms? So that's something that in the short to midterm, we're all really wondering. I think the big overarching question I have going into 2021 is, how are states and these local areas in Michigan that have been largely essentially tasked with figuring out this massive, unprecedented logistical challenge, how are they going to proceed with not just vaccinating healthcare workers, which in some ways, unfortunately, is the easy part because we know who they are. They all are essentially, employees of the same places that are giving these vaccines out. They're still running into all of the logistical challenges that come with that. As simple as there are hospitals where, they're not sure which form, do they need to fill out a different form to get the Moderna versus the, the other vaccine versus the Pfizer vaccine? We're still at that level of logistics being asked in some places. What is this going to look like as we try to broaden this to more people? And I think that's what everybody is wondering right now.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells and Dustin Dwyer, who both spent time in 2020 reporting on the COVID pandemic. Guys, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, April.
Still to come, we'll speak with Tim Alberta, correspondent for Politico, about a political year that was its own kind of pandemic. That's after a short break. Hang on, we'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, Congress is meeting to finalize the presidential election results and victory for President-elect Joe Biden. A number of congressional Republicans have already said that they plan to contest and debate the legitimacy of election results in key states, including Michigan. If you were tuned in to the news last month, you heard that the Trump campaign brought dozens of lawsuits against election results here and in other states. At least 60 of these suits were found to be without merit, and none came close to overturning Biden's victory. Nevertheless, Donald Trump's popularity among voters has offered a lot of validation to Republicans who contest the results, even when election managers in their own counties and states have affirmed the count. Here to help us try to wrap our minds around what's going on in the Republican Party, seemingly at war with itself, is Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico, and the author of a book that takes a deep look at the Republican Party under Donald Trump. It's called American Carnage. Tim Alberta, welcome back to Stateside.
April, it is great to be with you.
So here we are with some Republican House members, including all of Michigan's GOP reps for the 2021 Congress, saying that they support Donald Trump's attempt to hang on to the presidency. And what was news over the weekend is that 11 senators have joined in that call, typically the Senate being a more restrained body. Were you at all surprised?
It takes an awful lot to surprise me at this point in our political history, particularly when it comes to the Republican Party and its willingness to contort itself into positions that are unfamiliar and sort of in many ways unprecedented to show their allegiance to and fidelity to the president. But this, I think, does take it to a new level. And I say that, April, simply because there is nothing about what these members of Congress are suggesting that they will do that can have any impact whatsoever on the outcome of the presidential election. Each of these states has certified their results. Each of these states has sent one slate of electors to the Electoral College. The Electoral College has voted. Joe Biden won. Donald Trump lost. The only task before Congress is to get together and count those votes. It's really as simple as pretend you are the commissioner of a fantasy football league, and you wake up and print out the results of all the games, and you look over the scores, and then you announce to everybody, okay, here's the score. This is what happened. The idea that you are going to object to one of those scores, it's not just unfounded and pointless, but it's laughable. It's silly. There's nothing to this. And yet, the fact that so many members of Congress are so passionately investing themselves in this and throwing the credibility of their office behind this effort, I think it speaks volumes about where this party is, despite having lost the presidency in November, and where it's going over the next several years. Because, April, for all of the expectations we may have had that a Donald Trump defeat would free the party in some way from his grip and allow it to begin turning the page and rebuilding and moving on, if anything, the party seems to be tighter in the president's grip now than it was before he lost the election.
Here in Michigan, Trump supporters reflect a range of thought. You've got people like Bill Huizenga, congressman from Western Michigan, who recognizes Joe Biden as president-elect, but who also tacitly supported election challenges, saying everyone in Michigan should not have received absentee voting applications. And then you've got folks like incoming Representative Lisa McClain, who's coming into the 10th District, who co-signed a letter claiming that the U.S. election system is in total chaos. Is this range of thought in the Michigan delegation representative of what you're seeing from reps and senators nationally?
You know, I think so, although I would also add that the range we see nationally can stretch quite a bit further into the absurd and the truly extreme as far as conspiracy theories about international cabals planning the downfall of President Trump by tinkering with voting machines and members of Congress buying into that kind of thing. Ultimately, what you have is something of a self-fulfilling prophecy, something of a circular dynamic here, April, with so many of these people, in which they will give credence to the notion that this election was in some way illegitimate, that that Donald Trump was in some way cheated, that the process was in some way corrupt and unfair. And then they will turn around when asked why they are pressing forward with some of these unprecedented objections to the process of counting electoral votes, and with some of their attempts to subvert the democratic process that has kept this country afloat since 1776. And they will tell you that really there are so many Americans out there who have concerns about the integrity of our system that they would be derelict in their duty if they did not do these things. But of course, so many Americans are questioning the integrity of the electoral system because of what they're hearing from those elected officials in the first place. In other words, for one example, John James, the failed U.S. Senate candidate, on the morning after Election Day on November 4th, he and his campaign were blasting out a statement accusing Democrats of cheating, of stealing this election from him and from the Republicans. And then a few weeks later, pressed on why he was not conceding defeat in that U.S. Senate race, John James put out a video saying, "Listen, when half of the voters in my state believe that the election was cheated, then we have a real problem here." And it's like, well, wait a second. You are the one telling them in the first place that it was cheated. And so again, so much of this just becomes circular and self-fulfilling because they have in fact sort of helped to create this mythology around voter fraud. And so of course now they think that there are ample grounds to move forward and not only investigate but object to the certification of the results, object to the legitimacy of the incoming president.
Tim, there's something you said that I've been wondering a lot about. You said that there's absolutely nothing that the Electoral College objectors can do to change the process. It's not going to matter. And I kind of feel like that is the premise that a lot of the objectors have been using, if not behind the scenes, then at least maybe in their own minds. You know, they may understand that the election was fair and legal, but their trust in the process and the insistence that they have that this is about trust in the process is maybe a kind of cover. When you talk to people off the record, I'm not going to ask you to name names, but do you feel like that is something that they're at least tacitly willing to acknowledge, that they believe that they can't really do much damage to trust in the system in raising these issues?
You know, April, what I would say is that the overwhelming majority of folks who have been involved in these attempts to delegitimize this election at the local, state, and federal level, when you talk to them in off-the-record settings, they believe that what they're doing is harmless, that this is politics, that they're supposed to be leaving everything out on the field and that this is a blood sport and that ultimately we have a process in place that ensures that you know, the person who won the most votes ultimately takes office on January 20th and that any of the back and forth, any of the shenanigans, any of the, you know, even any of the foul play, frankly, leading up to January 20th will long be forgotten. That is the view of many Republicans who I've spoken with, that look, this idea that history is going to remember us for attempting to subvert this election, that's just crazy talk, right? They better hope they're right. My sense is that they're wrong. My sense is that what we've lived through in the last 7 or 8 weeks here is quite unprecedented, and that even though Republicans have been unsuccessful in attempting to steal this election for Donald Trump in 2020, they have in some way laid a blueprint, not a legal blueprint, because the president's legal efforts have really been quite laughable and have gone nowhere fast. But they've created a blueprint as far as spreading disinformation, stirring mass hysteria, fanning the flames of distrust in institutions ranging from the judiciary to the legislative branch of individual states to the elections process all the way down to the ballot box itself. And once that genie is out of the bottle, so to speak, April, I just don't know that you put it back in. But again, to answer your question, most Republicans I speak with, they're not terribly worried about it. They ultimately believe, and I should add, April, that most of them believe that Donald Trump did lose, that there was not some massive conspiracy to throw him out of office, that there was no widespread fraud. But they also believe that they're doing what they have to do to protect their future in a party that is committed to him in a way that I don't think we've ever seen any political party.
We're talking today with Tim Alberta, chief politics correspondent for Politico. Tim, the New York Times published a story today saying that the 11 senators who are flying in the face of Electoral College results are really kind of thwarting what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been trying to do and saying that he's been trying to keep the Senate together, to keep a united face, and that now this rift within the GOP is threatening all that. We really haven't heard a lot about Mitch McConnell's efforts to sort of keep things under control behind the scenes. What have you observed?
You know, it's interesting, April. If there's one person in the Republican Party who has pretty consistently been able to navigate the Trump era behind the scenes, it's been Mitch McConnell, and I say that just as a sort of tactical observation. He has exercised a pretty astonishing degree of control over his caucus, kept his Republican senators in line, in lockstep, in ways that are really quite remarkable. So to see this sort of a jailbreak from within his caucus, to see, you know, a dozen of his senators going out and not just defying him, but defying him in a medium that is so conspicuous. And listen, you know, Mitch McConnell said to his senators recently, he said, look, this is, you know, I think one of the more important votes any of us will ever take here, and urging them to understand the historic implications of attempting to, you know, reject the result of a free and fair election and disenfranchise tens of millions of voters, all in the name of demonstrating fidelity to a president who is leaving office in a matter of 2 weeks. He has tried to impress upon senators not only the futility of that, but also, you know, the illegitimacy of that action itself, right? I mean, for all of the talk of, you know, the election being illegitimate, what these people are attempting to do, what they say that they will attempt to do on the floor of the U.S. Senate, on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives in 2 days, it is in and of itself illegitimate. It is only the job of these folks, again, to get together and tally these votes and say, okay, well, here's what the count said. American elections are run on a state level. It is up to the states to ultimately conduct audits, to do recounts, investigations into the work of voting. Once those processes play out, once a state certifies its results, once it sends its slate of electors to the Electoral College, and once the Electoral College counts those votes, it's over. There's nothing left to be done. So Mitch McConnell, as much as he has curried favor with the president over the last 4 years and bent over backward to stay in the president's good graces and not alienate the MAGA base, even Mitch McConnell is looking around and saying to his members, guys, This is ridiculous. This is a joke. What you're trying to do here, not only will it not work, but it is designed not to work. That's not the system we have in place here. And for any of these folks to call themselves conservatives in the process is just sort of takes it to another degree of parody, because there's nothing less conservative than launching this sort of cartoonish frontal assault on American democracy. And Mitch McConnell knows it.
You said as much on Twitter yesterday, saying that we should not, for the rest of their careers, refer to any of the Republican Electoral College objectors as conservatives. Do you think that feeling is shared within the GOP?
You know, I'm not sure if it is or not. I just know that to be a conservative once meant something. And listen, institutional decline, April, is the story of our lifetimes, I believe. The loss of public confidence in everything from organized religion to public education to government itself and now to the ballot box, this is the overriding theme, I think, of our political lives. And the attempts to exploit that insecurity people feel with these institutions is, I think, just politically quite effective, but is ethically and morally repugnant. And the idea that conservatives, self-identified conservatives, people who conserve things, who conserve institutions, who are unwilling and really reluctant to challenge existing norms and to take on traditions and institutions, for these same people to be essentially prescribing an overthrow of the electoral process that we use in this country to choose presidents, it's just jaw-dropping. But then again, you have to remind yourself that the person whom they're trying to help in that regard is on the phone asking an elections official to go find votes for him to help make up his deficit in a state. I mean, this is all so incredibly bizarre and otherworldly that sometimes you have to pinch yourself to realize that this is actually happening. This is real. This is the President of the United States and his party sort of trying their best to break the democratic norms that define this country at its core. And my fear is not that it will work, but my fear is that it will, as I said earlier, have laid quite a blueprint for the next person who wants to try.
We're talking today with Tim Alberta of Politico. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're going to continue now my conversation with Tim Alberta. He's the Michigan-based chief political correspondent for Politico and the author of American Carnage, a book that takes a deep dive into the GOP in the era of Donald Trump. What you were just referring to is the revelation that Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, let out of the bag, that the president had called him and explicitly asked him to try to find the votes. One of the things that interested me about that story was seeing that not only did Donald Trump call him and say the things that were revealed in the tape, but that Trump called Raffensperger 18 times before the guy picked up. You reported a piece on Michigan's leaders under pressure from the Trump campaign. Is there any reason to think that similar calls might have been made in Michigan to Republican elected leaders here?
There is zero reason to not believe that those calls took place, because they, in fact, in some cases they did take place. And I'm sure that there are even more calls that took place that I'm unaware of, April. But what I can tell you is that in Michigan and in a handful of these other tightly contested states, although I should even back up and say that Michigan wasn't tightly contested, which is what made the efforts in Michigan so bizarre. The president lost the state by 154,000 votes plus. It just was not particularly competitive in the context of some of these other states, such as Arizona and Georgia. But the president had placed calls in those other states to see what could be done, if anything, to right the wrong, as he saw it, of the vote tallies ultimately showing Joe Biden on top. And you know what's interesting is that Raffensperger in Georgia has been under such incredible pressure and under such public assault. He and his wife have been receiving a deluge of death threats, and this is a Republican, mind you. And so he took the rather extraordinary step of taping the president in that conversation and releasing it to the public. And of course, we're all shocked at the president's audacity and potential illegality on that phone call. But my hunch, April, is that if we were able to gather the greatest hits of, you know, 10 or 12 or 20 of those phone calls made over the last couple of months from the president, we would be hearing a lot of the same and maybe even worse. And, you know, the fact that we can infer that about this president is, you know, I think obviously indicative of who he is. I would just step back from this really quickly, April, to share another quick anecdote here. I remember having this conversation in our newsroom a couple of years ago around the time of the 2018 midterm elections and talking with editors about you know how we should be prepared for what might happen if Trump lost in 2020. And a couple of people were sort of less certain of that than others. And I said, well, let me tell you a story. On caucus night in Iowa in 2016, when Donald Trump lost the Iowa caucuses to Ted Cruz, Donald Trump was at the tarmac on his private plane at the Des Moines airport. And he, over the objection of his campaign staff, he placed a call to the chairman of the Iowa Republican Party. And Trump said to the chairman, and this is at about 11:30 p.m., Ted Cruz is celebrating with his thousands of supporters at a big event. And Donald Trump tells the chairman of the Iowa Republican Party, Ted Cruz cheated, and I think you need to disavow the results. And the chairman was sort of stunned, and he said, well, what do you mean? I can't do that. And Trump said, no, he cheated. You need to disavow the results. And I couldn't stop thinking about that particular story from the opening days of 2016, long before Donald Trump was the Republican nominee, long before Donald Trump was the president. There was something there that we should have known that he would respond this way. And now that he has, we're shocked, of course, because we've never seen a president behave this way. But we really shouldn't be all that shocked, I suppose, is the moral of the story.
Yeah. There have been a lot of questions about whether former House Speaker Paul Ryan, you know, where he has been in all of this. For so long, he was a picture of new conservatism, some would say compassionate conservatism, and a future face for the GOP. He finally came out over the weekend to say that the Electoral College should be codified. You've talked with Paul Ryan an awful lot over the years. Do you see a role for guys like him in the way the party is going forward?
No, I don't. The short answer is no.
That was a real short answer, yeah.
Yeah, that's. I mean, look, I tend to be long-winded, so I need to occasionally offset that by giving you very short, succinct answers. No, listen, April, this party is just completely beholden to Donald Trump right now and his brand of politics and in his makeover and takeover of the Republican Party. Just at a structural level, it is going to take years for the party to try and move beyond Trumpism. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that the president is very likely going to spend the next, 24 to 36 months teasing us on a run for the presidency in 2024. Whether or not he winds up going through with it, of course, is another matter. But the president is in complete control of this party right now. And anyone who dares to step out of line with the Trump message just doesn't really stand a chance.
Are there ways that you think what's going on in the GOP are affecting what's happening across the aisle?
It's a good question. I certainly think that you have the beginnings of a real fight for the identity of the Democratic Party. The one thing that Democrats will tell you, whether they are sort of Chamber of Commerce, business-friendly, very centrist Democrats, or far-left, progressive, democratic socialists, what they will tell you across the board is that the Democratic Party suffers from having a lack of identity. People don't know what the Democrats are for. And listen, for better or worse, people know what Republicans are for. People know what Trump is for. People understand what the Republican Party is and what it isn't. And the struggle that Democrats have is that in the vacuum of that identity, you have some really sharply diverging visions for what the party should represent. And listen, Joe Biden enters office as almost this sort of caretaker president, as someone who has promised to be a bridge to the next generation of Democrats. But he also comes in with a threadbare majority in the House of Representatives and very possibly with a small Republican majority in the U.S. Senate, or at the very best case scenario, a 50-50 tie that would be broken in the Senate by Kamala Harris. All of which is to say that Joe Biden has no room to maneuver. He has no margin for error. And in some sense, April, maybe Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe Joe Biden, because he is so constrained, is forced to work to cobble together bipartisan majorities on everything he does. Maybe that doesn't make for big, sexy, flashy lawmaking, but maybe it does return some degree of normalcy and functionality to the federal government. And maybe people see that back home their constituents appreciate that and they are rewarded for it. And maybe that helps to sort of slowly improve this very warped incentive system that we have in our politics at the moment. I'm not terribly optimistic about any of that happening, but I do think that Joe Biden is acutely aware of those tension points in the Democratic Party, and he's quite concerned about the possibility of a sort of all-out civil war engulfing the Democrats the same way that it has engulfed the Republicans. And I think that Biden sees his job, at least politically, in sort of bridging that divide between the factions in his party and trying to sort of just get some things done. Done while also signaling a willingness to embrace some of these progressive causes that the Democratic Party has been, you know, very slowly moving towards in recent years.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico and a native of Michigan.
Well, so what do those realities mean for a Democrat like Alyssa Slotkin from Michigan? The Democratic House members just took a vote to select House Speaker, and Nancy Pelosi was narrowly reelected. Alyssa Slotkin was one of five Democrats who just voted present, did not vote for Pelosi or for another candidate. She kind of abstained. What does that tell you?
Well, look, I've spent some time with Ms. Slotkin and talked with her about that vote just after the election when she had said that she wouldn't vote for Pelosi again. And I think that, you know, if you're Alyssa Slotkin, you're sort of in a lose-lose position here. If you vote for Nancy Pelosi, then you incur the wrath of a lot of your constituents, particularly your independents and your moderates who believe that Pelosi is either no longer fit to hold that position of speaker because she's been there too long or because she's too intransigent and you know, isn't willing to negotiate with Republicans or whatever the case may be. Nancy Pelosi has pretty high negatives in a district like Slotkin's, and Slotkin knows that, and so that's why she pledged the last two campaigns not to support Pelosi. But on the other hand, there's nobody running against Pelosi. There's no challenge to her, and you can't beat something with nothing in politics. And so ultimately, Slotkin votes present as a way of just kind of showing her disapproval with Pelosi, and she believes that there should be fresh blood and a new generation of leadership in the Democratic Party. But ultimately, she's not going to sort of go out on a limb and cast a vote for somebody who's not running for the position, because that would just sort of be silly. Alyssa Slotkin is one of a number of these young, you know, sort of political outsiders, people who came to elected office in the 2018 midterm who had been, you know, in business or who had been in the military or who had been in national security, some sort of a relatively apolitical background. And these people are sort of fed up with the status quo. They're fed up with the inability of Washington to get anything done. They're fed up with these sort of zero-sum negotiations. There are people in both parties who would like to see things change in Congress. Slotkin has a really interesting case to make in that regard, but Congress remains, April, this just sort of hopelessly top-down, almost anti-democratic institution in many ways. And people in the abstract want to see that system change. But a lot of those same people understand that the current system, the status quo, actually protects them. It protects them from taking tough votes. It protects them from having to sort of be exposed on any number of different issues where they're pretty comfortable kind of staying in the shadows. So the status quo is embraced for a reason. You know, the House money tends to win in these situations. And so Slotkin is a lot like any number of members I've covered over the years. Will Hurd comes to mind, a Republican from Texas who just retired. Really impressive, moderate young member who comes in believing that he's going to change the place. And three terms later, he retires because he realizes that there is no changing the place. And I see some of that in Alyssa Slotkin.
Mm. Tim, I got to say, it's been a while since we've talked. You sound a bit like someone who's pretty done with people telling him that the sky is green when it's actually blue. It so happens that some of that weariness with the dual realities that are playing out in the Democratic and Republican parties, some of what you have to say is and some of what you're observing is in line with the way Democrats are describing the situation right now. How would you say 2020 challenged you? And are there ways that you're going to be doing your job any differently in 2021?
Well, I would say this, April. I just, I have a, what I believe to be a pretty high tolerance for spin and for BS and for kind of political gamesmanship. And I think what we've seen in the last couple of months is something very, very different, and frankly, something very dangerous. And I've been around a lot of these people long enough to know who they are and what they believe and what they're willing to do to hold on to power. And maybe, if I'm being honest, maybe I've turned a blind eye to it for too long and too many times, but I just sort of reach a breaking point when it comes to the nakedly cynical motivations and actions of some of these people who are willing to put their own political careers and their own political self-interest, their own financial self-interest, frankly, before the good of the country and before the institutions that are just, you know, again, the bedrock of this democratic experiment of ours. And I don't know that it's possible to maintain relationships with people who I believe to be sort of fundamentally and knowingly and deliberately undermining democracy in this country. And so, you know, the last couple of months have been pretty hard. It's been a hard year all around, and certainly there are a lot of people who are out there hurting and hungry and mourning lost loved ones. And I don't mean to put my plight on par with theirs, but I will say that the last couple of months have been, I think, the most challenging of my career, in that I've had to permanently sever ties with an awful lot of people who have been, you know, sources of mine over the years, who I've had good working relationships with. You know, I've disagreed with them plenty, and give them a kick in the chops from time to time when they've deserved it. But ultimately, people who I believed were patriots and who had the best interests of this country at heart. And some of them I no longer believe that. And it's been difficult to sort of come to terms with that. And as far as moving forward, I'll have more to say on that at a later date. But suffice it to say that I think it's healthy for me.
Oh no! Don't do this to me.
Well, I'll just say for now. Suffice it to say for now that it's healthy for me, and I think probably healthy for a lot of other people in my position to take a step away from politics for a while and not allow all of this shenanigans and all of this bad faith to dim the light that we have to do this job and to try and report the truth and keep the public informed. This is a very strange time in this country. It's a very strange time to be politically aware and to be politically active in this country. And it's certainly a strange time to cover the news in this country. And I, for one, need a break.
Tim Alberta is chief politics correspondent for Politico. Tim, thank you for your work, and we're looking forward to hearing about your plans for 2021.
Thanks, April. I appreciate you having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. It's very good to have you back with us in the new year. Thanks for listening. See you next time.